listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Although it didn't get much coverage in a country where a terrorist attack on a house of worship is still unusual, and where bombs delivered to politicians do not explode, on Monday the UN Security Council considered yet again the situation in Syria. This was Mark Lowcock, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, reporting to the Security Council, which is presided over this month by the plurinational state of Bolivia.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Good morning. I concluded my briefing for you last month with a question. Would the agreement reached between the Russian Federation and Turkey on Idlib provide only a moment of respite, or would it represent the start of a more stable future for millions of civilians in that part of the country? We have seen a glimmer of hope in the weeks of relative quiet since the agreement was reached. It's extremely important for millions of people in Idlib that that remains the case. The stakes are very high because the alternative is humanitarian suffering on a scale that would overwhelm all ability to respond, devastating a population that's already weakened through years of conflict, displacement, and deprivation. Mr. President, the United Nations and partner organizations continue to reach people in need throughout Syria. Over the first 7 months of the year, in total across the country, an average of almost 5.5 million people were reached with life-saving assistance every month. In September, nearly 2.5 million people were reached with food aid from Damascus. That includes some people in areas that have recently come under the control of the government, with assistance often delivered through the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. However, in many areas that recently changed control, the United Nations has not had sustained access. We've discussed this with the Syrian authorities, who've made clear that areas under their control should now be reached in a comprehensive and regular manner from Damascus. They've also agreed to facilitate a greater number of missions and that we can more systematically deploy United Nations personnel with aid that's often delivered in partnership with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. We look forward to rapid implementation of that approach. It will allow our teams on the ground to undertake essential independent assessments of the situation and see more of who is being helped and how. At the same time, we will continue to submit plans for government agreement for cross-line access into northwest Syria. Mr. President, this leads me to a broader point I wanted to make about the approach we're taking to assessing and meeting humanitarian needs across Syria. The UN's mandate for humanitarian action, set by you in your series of resolutions, and also by the General Assembly in Resolution 46182, adopted in 1991, requires us to consult the government. We think that's very important. At the same time, our mandate also emphasises the principles of independence, impartiality, and neutrality in humanitarian action, in particular to ensure that assistance is provided on the basis of need and not driven or determined by any other considerations. The humanitarian system is, as you know, financed on a voluntary basis. The main questions I'm asked by all those whose help I seek in financing humanitarian action everywhere around the world are always the same. How do you know what the needs are? And how do we know, if we give you money, that it will really get to the people who need it most? If people whose money we're seeking are not persuaded by the answers we provide to those questions, my experience is that they do not give us the money we ask for. So ensuring that we work on the basis of the humanitarian principles is both a matter of complying with our mandates, as we want and as we must do, but it's also a matter of practical necessity. I've discussed these issues in detail with the government on a number of occasions in recent weeks. These discussions have led to important agreements in extending the UN's ability to assess needs as comprehensively as possible, fully in compliance with our mandate, as we prepare the humanitarian needs overview and the UN coordinated response plan that we'll be publishing for Syria for 2019. I hope to be able to report progress to you in carrying out expanded needs assessment exercises in the next few months. Mr. President, the United Nations cross-border operation from Turkey has continued to reach hundreds of thousands of people in need every month. It has been scaled up in recent weeks to ensure pre-positioning of assistance as a contingency measure for the event of military escalation, as well as to provide winterization support. Nearly 1,000 trucks are delivering plastic sheeting, winter clothes and boots, heaters and stoves. Critical supplies also continue to be delivered into northeast Syria through the Al-Yarabiya border crossing from Iraq. In the first 9 months of 2018, over 750,000 people on average each month were reached with food aid through UN cross-border activities. Sustaining this is essential for those in need, both providing aid and supporting service delivery. It's for that reason that the extension of the provisions of Resolutions 2165 and 2393 remain of the highest importance. The Secretary General, in his report, and I now call upon the Council to renew the resolution for another 12 months. Cross-border operations continue to be very closely managed and monitored. We continue to take every step possible to ensure United Nations operations meet the highest standards. The way we do that was reviewed in detail earlier this year at the request of the Council, and we reported on it to you in June. We train implementing partners and local authorities on the implementation of international humanitarian law. We advocate for principled delivery of assistance with non-state armed opposition groups inside Syria. And we've developed a code of conduct signed by most non-state armed groups operating in northwest Syria, committing them to respect international humanitarian law. We also take all possible steps to ensure compliance with money laundering and counter-terrorism legislation applicable to the United Nations. Mr. President, let me turn to other areas of concern in Syria. In Rukban, on the Syria-Jordan border, the UN, in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, had prepared to undertake a large delivery of assistance from Damascus for 50,000 people, a vaccination campaign for some 10,000 children, and a rapid needs assessment. The convoy was planned for Saturday, just past the 27th of October, but reports of insecurity along the route forced us to postpone it. The population at Rukban has not received assistance since January this year, and they are increasingly desperate. There are continuing reports of children dying due to poor sanitary conditions and a lack of health care. This dire humanitarian situation cannot be allowed to continue. The UN is ready and willing to proceed with the convoy immediately. So my message to all concerned is please make the necessary arrangements to ensure the security of the humanitarian personnel and the accompanying convoy so it can proceed without delay. Intense fighting continues to affect civilians along the east bank of the Euphrates River in southern parts of Deir ez-Zor Governorate. There have been reports of dozens of civilian deaths and more injuries as Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by international coalition forces, engage in hostilities in the final remaining ISIL enclave in Syria. Some 7,000 people have been displaced from Hajin due to fighting in recent weeks. Up to 15,000 remain trapped inside ISIL-controlled areas. An attack by ISIL on one of the camps where displaced people were staying has reportedly resulted in death and injury of civilians, as well as the abduction of more than 100 people. Some of them have since reportedly been killed. While I remain concerned also about the situation in Raqqa, I do want to report to you that the United Nations has had increasing access to the area. A September assessment mission by the World Health Organization found that health needs in Raqqa remain great, with an acute shortage of all levels of healthcare services in the city. Assistance also continues to be provided to Raqqa City and the northeast, with the United Nations and our partner organizations now reaching more than 600,000 people a month. So, Mr. President, in summary and in conclusion, there are five areas where we now seek the support of member states and of the Security Council. First, continuing implementation of the agreement between the Russian Federation and Turkey and the prevention of a military onslaught on Idlib and the surrounding areas, the humanitarian impact of which would, as we have repeatedly told you, be absolutely devastating to the civilian population. Second, renewal for another year of Resolution 2165, in particular to sustain cross-border aid essential to support and protect more than 3 million civilians in Idlib, most of them women and children, and for essential supplies and services across the north of Syria. Third, support to ensure that our United Nations and Syrian Arab Red Crescent humanitarian convoy is granted secure access to Rukban camp immediately. Fourth, support for our efforts to improve access, needs assessment, and evidence gathering on how the resources we've raised are being used. And finally, continued and more generous financing for our current humanitarian response plan. While I am, on behalf of millions of Syrians who are the beneficiaries, extremely grateful for the $1.7 billion we've raised so far in 2018, this year's plan is still less than 50% funded. Thank you very much indeed.
After an hour of comments from various members of the Security Council, the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic to the United Nations, Ambassador Bashar al-Ja'afari, addressed the Council.
Shukran, Sayyid al-Rais.
Thank you, Mr. President. I join my colleagues in expressing condolences to the people and government in Kindred, Indonesia, as a result of the disaster of that civilian aircraft. Mr. President, it is very much in bad taste that some delegations, Western delegations, are mixing politics and the humanitarian side of things. These delegations continue to set obstacles in the path of humanitarian access, which should be transparent, sincere, and non-politicized. These delegations claim that there will be no humanitarian action without responding to the strategic, ambitious designs of these countries. We have heard these same delegations set a number of political prior conditions that try to empty humanitarian action of all of its content and move it towards a political instrumentalization of the suffering of the Syrian people. Mr. President, I would like to recall that today's meeting is taking place or coincides with an attack committed by the so-called coalition against the El Hajin region in Deir ez-Zor, using white phosphorus, which is internationally prohibited. This caused the death of an entire family, the mother, the father, and the children. The last meeting on the 24th of October coincided with a criminal terrorist attack perpetrated by armed groups in Idlib against Aleppo. This shelling saw the use of 40 missiles. Terrorist groups in Idlib launched 40 missiles against Aleppo, which killed dozens of people and injured dozens of civilians. On the 17th of September, coalition aircraft bombed Al-Susa and Boubadran in Deir ez-Zor, which led to the death of dozens of civilians as well. This was the session before last. All of that highlights and puts under a microscope the designs of the Western countries that have spoken about humanitarian needs in my country and who are attempting to manipulate OCHA. The United Nations Humanitarian Wing. Allow me, Mr. President, to congratulate you and through you, your country, the plurinational state of Bolivia, for the successful conduct of the work of the Security Council in October. Your presidency has genuinely taken care of the job entrusted to you by genuinely preserving, maintaining international peace and security and respecting the provisions of the Charter. Many member states of this organization, are thus very proud of this excellent quality work done by the Bolivian mission. Mr. President, during the various meetings held recently between the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mr. Lowcock, with Syrian officials, during those meetings, the need to coordinate common actions between the two parties for a better understanding and to remove obstacles and improve the role of the United Nations in the humanitarian sphere in accordance with General Assembly Resolution 46/182 governing OCHA, this need was confirmed at those meetings, and that in spite of a drop in the intensity of United Nations humanitarian action in Syria, which Mr. Lowcock spoke about, and a drop in financing due to unilateral coercive measures undertaken by the United States and the member states of the European Union against the Syrian people. And this demonstrates that tens of millions of people, tens of thousands of people need assistance due to these coercive measures. even though they say that the figures are quite different. The Syrian government is convinced of the importance of the role that its member states grant to the organization. Damascus continues to count on this role to help Syrians who have suffered from the terrorist war imposed upon my country, Syria. A role which will preserve the credibility and effectiveness of the organization, a role which would respect the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic. As your resolutions state, there are currently 28 political and humanitarian resolutions. They all confirm the need to preserve the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic and its people. A neutral, independent, objective role which does not chime with the blackmail of some countries is one that is based naturally on the Charter of the United Nations. Mr. President, we took note with very great interest of the briefing delivered by Mr. Lowcock and, of course, the report being considered. Allow me to make some remarks, which will undoubtedly answer the questions from some colleagues. First of all, there is a vital need to conduct a transparent, objective, professional dialogue to modify the information reporting mechanism concerning the humanitarian situation in Syria, so that the objective of these reports can genuinely be to provide assistance to the Syrians that need it. Continuing to submit these reports on a monthly basis is a waste of time, money, and human resources. We affirm that they should be replaced by quarterly reports to the extent that much of the information in these reports is outdated information. For example, in the report before us, we are looking at what took place 1 or 2 months ago, whereas we should really be considering what is taking place at the moment in the current month. Secondly, there is an urgent need to have a transparent, objective, professional discussion of the content of these reports so that they are not used by some to exert pressure and blackmail. It is not reasonable and it is in bad taste when everybody has understood that there is a terrible terrorist war going on in Syria this year and that the sponsoring of terrorist groups is considered to be the chief responsible for this. We do not need to speak before the Congress and the Senate, which this month published the chief of staff and so on. This is not necessary because you know all of this already. And so, after it has been established that the government sponsor and financing of these terrorist groups has been recognized, and this has been acknowledged by all that these are armed terrorist groups which continue to take civilians as a human shield and which use hospitals and schools as a military base from which to launch their terrorist operations. Once everybody has understood that the source of lies targeting the Syrian government is terrorist groups and their champions, after all of that, it is then in bad taste for the authors of reports to continue to write their reports in a negative, politicized way against the Syrian Arab Republic and its institutions. All the more so because it makes many errors and deviates from its mandate and ignores deliberately the observations and remarks provided by the Syrian Arab Republic during previous reports to the Secretariat of the United Nations. 56 times we have presented formal responses to OCHA's reports. We have provided clear answers to all of the questions, but these comments were not relayed in OCHA's reports, never. For years, we have been trying to establish cooperation links with OCHA, and we ask OCHA for all of the necessary information. But our remarks do not attract the interest of OCHA officials. The remarks and observations from witnesses and the White Helmets are relayed, but not the information provided by the Syrian government. Thirdly, it is surprising that the report claims that the government did not authorize the humanitarian convoy plan for September and October. What we heard today from Mr. Lo Hocock confirmed that. But the truth is that the government of my country asked the United Nations to include the liberated areas, which were included in the assistance plan as besieged or hard-to-reach areas. We asked for those areas to be included in the interagency convoy plan, in the humanitarian delivery plan. But the United Nations did not include these areas in the plan. I don't know what the answer to that is. You can ask Mr. Lowcock for that answer. Fourthly, when it comes to the delivery of assistance to Rukban camp, we know that it's, if my geographic information is correct, we know where it is, because some have spoken as though this were a camp in Somalia or the Maldives. But it's not. It's in Syria. I can confirm that the Syrian government has given its agreement to United Nations institutions to deliver assistance to the camp in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and the ICRC directly, because it's on the territory of the Syrian Arab Republic. But the United Nations group, after approaching the 55th kilometer on the 26th of this month, returned to Damascus quickly because of the deterioration of the humanitarian situation and because, according to reports, an imminent Daesh attack was going to be perpetrated against the convoy from the zone controlled by the Americans. And this is even though the United States gave the United Nations assurances as to the security of the convoy for the delivery of this camp, which is in Somalia. This is proof that the United States is impeding the delivery of assistance to Rukban, and that is the source of the suffering. Daesh has moved towards Suwayda and has attacked and killed around 300 civilians at dawn. These terrorists came back from Suwayda to the Altanf and Rukban area, which is in Somalia. Fifthly, my country regrets that the authors of the report, in accordance with the directive of some Western countries, are defending cross-border assistance, even though its ineffectiveness has been proven and it is not guaranteed that it will reach the destination of this assistance. And it also provides indirect assistance to terrorists who seize it and use it to fuel their terrorist activities in Syria. For months, we have been asking for many clarifications over this assistance and the assistance provided. We've still not received clarifications on that front. Mr. President, today, thanks to the safer, more stable situation on the ground, and thanks to the victory over terrorism, and thanks to the government's reconstruction of terrorist-destroyed areas and the return to normal life, the conditions are now in place for the voluntary return of Syrian refugees who had left their homeland due to terrorism and unilateral coercive measures, which deprive them of their means of survival, of their livelihoods. The return of thousands of refugees from abroad is happening, even though Western countries are trying to prevent them from doing so by intimidating them with weak pretexts and using humanitarian concerns as a card to implement their geopolitical designs and setting that in between the political side and the humanitarian side. What we have heard today through the from the delegation of some Western countries confirms this. Lastly, Mr. President, as we are writing the final chapter in the Syrian crisis, Syrians are determined to work together to do away with the effects of the terrorist war and to rebuild their country with their own hands and thanks to their own people and capacities, whether it be those who have stayed in the country or those who have been forced to leave it because of terrorism. As for what was said by some about Idlib, I would like to remind all of you that Idlib is a Syrian city. No one more than the Syrian government has concern for the city and its inhabitants. They have been taken as a human shield by terrorist groups. My country reaffirms the Sochi Agreement concluded on the 17th of September. The Syrian government will continue to facilitate all attempts to cease the spilling of Syrian blood. We welcome all initiatives to bring peace and security to all of the Syrian territory that has been struck by terrorism. My government reaffirms also that it will continue to combat terrorism until it liberates the last part of Syrian territory from the grip of terrorists and all foreign military presence which is present illegitimately on Syrian territory. Thank you, Mr. President.
A U.S.-backed war on Syria, in Syria, has been waged by the United States and its NATO allies through local proxies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, among others, since March of 2011. Estimates of casualties from the UN and other international actors range from 400,000 to over 1 million dead, and millions more made refugees, both internally and internationally.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Relationship experts always recommend that troubled couples keep talking to one another in a way that's direct enough to expose mutual grievances, but also sensitive enough not to make things worse. That seems like valid advice on the eve of the second meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, but is that enough to pull the current U.S.-Russia relationship out of a tailspin? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Andrei Sushentsov, Director of the Institute of International Studies at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. Mr. Sushentsov, it's good to see you. Thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you use a lot of psychoanalytic terms in your articles. For example, the fundamental attribution error, which, according to you, afflicts both Russia and the United States in their analysis of each other's actions. If we take this political psychoanalysis a bit further, how would you diagnose the current state of mind on both sides of the Atlantic?
We have a very deep symmetry of perception in what's going on. Like Americans, they don't assess probably the strategic consequence of the current sanctioned regime. They're very self-absorbed. They see what's going on through the election period as a malevolent Russian interference aimed at destroying American power. They're focused on it, and they're thinking that that was basically a crossing a red line, an act of war almost. I'm speaking about the Washington elite, Washington consensus. From the Russian part, it's absolutely not clear what exactly has happened in Washington, but they assess that the strategic consequence of this American response in form of the sanction is a classical American strategy of deterring and possibly dismantling Russia. And this is how it basically brings us to the point where we both perceive different things about one another, not interacting directly, but eventually thinking the most malevolent thing about one another.
I heard you say just recently that the key feature of our time as far as foreign policy is concerned is uncertainty. And tolerance to uncertainty, how you process it, how you live with it, is a key feature of emotional stability. The lack of it, at least according to Freud, leads to neurosis. I wonder if this is where we are, the neurotic stage, or has it gone further to, let's say, paranoia?
Well, we are a bit paranoid. We have this uncertainty, which is structural. World is in anarchy, a lot of strategic actors, everybody are playing their game. But we also have this misplaced certainty about something that we actually know very little, but we take for granted.
Like, you know, like what, for example?
Like, you know, American elite believes that Russia has a malign idea to elect American president.
Well, and in the same fashion, I think Russians, many Russians at least, believe that Americans are out to get it and to put Russia on its knees whenever the opportunity arises.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the most cited American author here is Zbigniew Brzezinski, great chessboard, and Russian philosopher something, Alexander Dugin, is the most cited in the West, which is like a mirror paranoid image of one another.
Now, since you mentioned some authors, let me bring up another, Joseph Heller, the author of the famous Catch-22 novel, which is also frequently cited in political circles. And he is famous for saying that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that they are not after you. In your personal estimation, to what extent are Russia and the United States guilty of what each side attributes to one another?
Well, I think we are investing far more in the armaments than in preparing experts on both sides. Like, it costs 100 million rubles to create a caliber missile. And it costs like 5 million rubles to create a good, to prepare a good expert on the American studies at McGill, say. And the vice versa. In the United States, Russia is not a field of, you know, focused education for professionals, people who do Russian studies in the State Department and some other places.
But, you know, I know you're very much an advocate of a better Russian outreach to the United States, and I want to challenge this idea a little bit, because from my point of view, at least, the current Russian-American crisis was created by the people who weren't ignorant about Russia. They understood Russian reasoning very well. They just didn't like that reasoning. Is the problem really the lack of expertise rather than simple disagreement with each other's intentions and view of the world?
Well, there is structural disagreements about how the world functions and who should lead it, how the system should look like. Russia focuses on polycentric system. Americans would like to maintain primacy. That is clear, but we could have avoided unnecessary crises, the crises which have emanated from like uncertainty or a misplaced certainty. Like, we thought you were doing this, and we are responding to this. And this happens on both sides. I'm actually thinking that we underinvest understanding of one another.
Now, on the bright side, there is at least a realization that something needs to be done about it. Let's talk specifically about the upcoming Paris meeting and between the two leaders. And just the other day, President Putin's press secretary said that since that meeting is going to take place on the sidelines of an international memorial event, it has to be incorporated into that event's agenda. And it wasn't quite clear whether he meant the technical schedule or the substantive agenda. But I wonder if you think that that specific event, the celebrations of the World War I armistice, could lend any symbolic significance, any positive symbolism perhaps to the struggling U.S.-Russia ties?
Well, those parallels between the First World War and current time, I find them misplaced. I don't think that we actually have a situation like this. So, symbolically speaking, we have a much, much bigger events. You know, for Russian elites, American interference in the Russian election during the Yeltsin time was very formative period. That is the metaphor we use. Americans currently consider Russia to be partly responsible for Trump, and that can be a formative period for them. So I don't think that symbolically that would actually work. But
you know, one parallel that I would draw, as I was preparing for this interview, I was refreshing my memory on that armistice. And the striking thing about it, for me at least, was its negotiating process, or rather the lack of it, because the Germans were simply given the list of Allied demands, and some of those demands were impossible to begin with. For example, the Germans were initially required to decommission more submarines than their fleet possessed. And I think from the Russian point of view, the Americans are also coming forward with non-existent claims, like the claim of Russia's excessive interference. Do you think that claim should and would be brought to the table in Paris?
I think this idea of the Russian interference, this topic, is a kind of a bombshell in the American political context. But basically, they interpret through the foreign interference something they don't understand. They don't understand the Trump phenomena. They cannot
get... So it's their way of dealing with the uncertainty that we mentioned
earlier.
Yeah,
or like this is a kind of a misplaced certainty. So we're sure that Russians have supported him. This is why he elected. But look, guys, what will happen if he will be reelected? You know, would you blame anybody else?
Well, that meeting in Paris is going to take place about a week after the American midterm elections. Are you sure that the sore losers, whoever they happen to be this time around, will not be tempted to play the Russia card again?
I think it will be played for at least two consecutive years till the next presidential elections, because it's such a
and
big topic.
And then, for some reason, Russians would lose this miraculous capacity of putting the American leaders into the White House.
You know, these Russians, we just don't know what they can do. You know, Elvis Presley landing on the moon, everything that you can imagine, or you cannot explain, actually, can be interpreted for Russia. But the thing is that for Russian-American relations, we're currently, like, witnessing the dissolution of a single subject from the American side. So it's we would not get a deal if we deal only with American president. We need to send signals to American establishment who are currently very contrarian toward their president. Washington as a city, very like oppositional. They voted in favor of Clinton 96%.
So in addition to influencing the American leader, we also have to invest in influencing their entire political class.
Well, at least, you know, communicating with them, sending a signal that, you know, guys, it's absolutely your thing what is going on in Washington. We have no idea and no interest, actually.
But you seem to be premising your argument on the idea that they genuinely believe that to be the case, and it is hard for me to accept. I'm pretty sure that people, let's say, in the Obama or Hillary Clinton camp know what they were doing. There was a very deliberate decision. We know it from the leaked Hillary Clinton emails to kind of entangle Trump with Russia.
That's one thing. Like, you know, in terms of the political technology, as we call it, yes, the decision to play this Russian card came 24 hours after the defeat. But actually, if you speak with people like in American congressional staff or anybody in the ministries, Pentagon, State Department, it is very deep-rooted and widespread idea or belief unsubstantiated that Russia has a big thing inside this topic.
But, you know, I don't remember who said that, but it's essentially the more outrageous thing is, the easier it is to believe in it. So to some extent, if you make exorbitant claims, you don't really have to prove them.
That's one thing, but they don't make it like in a cynical way. We just blame you because we want to blame you. They believe in it. And this is very hard to grasp, like sitting here in Moscow.
Now, you made the point in one of your recent articles that the Russian leadership also seems fatigued by its own efforts to normalize the relationship with Washington. The previous meeting in Helsinki showed that the better the personal chemistry between the two leaders is, the worse it is for the bilateral relationship. Is that tendency likely to continue after Paris?
Well, it was clear that Russian executive authorities have invested heavily in this bilateral summit. And seeing that it didn't produce any positive results, Trump was paralyzed, Trump was attacked for this meeting. It was considered to be a failure of American diplomacy. It's clear that he has a lot of resistance inside his own administration. So we actually need to not only communicate with him, but with all of the guys who are trying to constrain and prevent him from doing what they see as a treason.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Sushantsov, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Andrei Sushantsov, Director of the Institute of International Studies at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. Mr. Sushantsov, the Kremlin made it known that one of its priorities for the Paris meeting is some sort of a dialogue on the announced American pullout from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And I think the Kremlin also treats that as a given rather than a negotiating tactic on the part of Trump. If the Russians are not going to try to persuade the Americans to stay in, what is it that Russia is after?
Well, it's clear that Americans would like to withdraw. They actually, they have not claimed that they have already withdrawn. But it's a good premise to consider them being withdrawing. It's a very direct and clear line that they want to do it. As John Bolton put it, it's now a multipolarity of these missile technologies. They are more focused on China rather than Russia, even though they have, as a first argument, used this Russia violation claim. It is, of course, unfortunate development. It wouldn't lead necessarily as a first step to the aggravation of tensions in European theater. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking about Europe more specifically, I think Moscow was quite relieved to see both the German and the French concerns expressed over this announced pullout. Does that mean, though, that the deployment of ground-launched missiles in Europe is out of the question, because some would suggest Poland may be looking into that opportunity?
We hope that these missiles would not come back to Europe. That would draw the our time back in like 30-40 years. They are not necessary. There are no structural problems in European security that would be closed by this implementing of this program. Iranian threat is not
that big. You know, it's those issues are decided not, or at least brought up, not only because of some strategic considerations, but also often because of political considerations. And obviously, Poland has an axe to grind with Russia. As far as Poland is concerned, do you think this it is more beneficial for it to continue at least floating an opportunity like that, or do you think it may come back and bite it, for example, in straining the NATO unity against Russia?
Well, if those missiles would happen to emerge in Poland, the Russian response would be automatic, of course, but it would be a response. Russia is not interested in provoking this kind of tensions. We hope that our Polish friends would be sane enough to avoid this development. Europe doesn't need it.
But I think it's clear that even before they can be deployed, there's going to be a huge discussion, and it's clear what position Germany and perhaps France are going to take. They're going to be strongly against it. Having said that, though, if Poland pursues that route rhetorically, do you think that's going to be a Russia problem or an EU problem? Because as far as I'm concerned, I think that would make it very difficult for Germany to maintain this unity against Russia.
Well, I hope that would become a Europe problem rather than Russia problem, because basically this would trigger events in the direction that it would not only be considered a Polish or a Russian question, but all the European question, Russian NATO question. And we need in this respect to speak to the capable, those in Western Europe who consider military threat as negligible currently in Europe, and try to maybe together with France and Germany develop an argument that would be satisfactory to those who feel threatened, say, by Russia.
Now, I heard you say recently that the Russian diplomatic and military schools, as well as Russian people as a whole, tend to be historic pessimists, in a sense that if something is working, it's not advisable to try to create something new in its place. And Vladimir Putin, I think, called that Russian conservatism. But there are some people who can call it complacency. Don't you think that it's indeed complacent on Russia's part to continue abiding by this treaty, while many countries in Russia's immediate neighborhood move ahead with development of that kind of weaponry?
Well, I think we should get a sense of how Russia sees international stability and why international stability is so cherished. Russian historical experience shows that peace is fragile and it can be ruined at any moment. And if something is working, you don't need it voluntarily violate out of hope that this can bring a better possibility in the future somewhere. If something is working, it's like a family relationship. If they're working, you don't just break them because you find some other attractive partner. And in this respect, I think an experimenting in this strategic sphere is what troubles me, even though, like Bolton says, that we don't see this being a great trouble for international strategic stability. It will be.
But you mentioned John Bolton, and in his op-ed a few years ago, explaining why this treaty was bad and why the United States should not abide by it, he specifically quoted Sergei Ivanov, former defense minister of Russia, making pretty much the same argument that it's not fair for only Moscow and Washington to be constrained by the treaty while everybody else moves forward with the development. Don't you think that at least partially some people in Moscow are relieved that the days of this treaty are numbered, specifically because of the military capabilities, the growing military capabilities of Russia's immediate neighbors?
Well, we indeed, in a sense, live in a multipolar missile system. China, Iran, and North Korea, they are developing this kind of facilities. But actually, the proper way forward would be a universal agreement about this, an inclusion of China.
You know very well that it's not possible because China...
That's true, but...
Can never agree to that. I mean, for good reason.
But we had a period in our relations 2007, 2008, where we together with United States invited them to join that. And I think that's a better idea. Imagine that we approach the same way the Treaty of Non-Proliferation of Weapons of Mass Destruction. The United States just withdraws and said, you know, we will just go ahead. That is non-constructive. That is not stable.
But I think it's also not very constructive to... ask China to abandon intermediate-range ballistic missiles when 95% of its nuclear arsenal is based on that class of weapons. I mean, even if China wants to demonstrate some goodwill, does it have a technical and military capacity to give what is being asked of it?
Yeah, but this is the situation where you take decisions out of like major uncertainty and you aggravate this uncertainty. With this regime, you have some certainty, while the structural premise of all the system is uncertainty. But just destroying the regime, you're making the uncertainty bigger. Mm-hmm. Why?
Now, you mentioned that the American side specifically cited its concerns over China's growing arsenal of intermediate-range ballistic missiles. China is now a global leader in that class of weapons. How much of a concern is the Chinese arsenal for Russia?
Strategically speaking, we are on the same page with Chinese. We have a very... friendly, trusted relations which have been maturing for several decades. And comparing them to Russian-American relations, they are like in absolutely different categories. We have like zero perception that China can be planning something against us. And we have, like metaphorically speaking, we in Europe and China in the Pacifics, we are facing the same adversary, basically. We are standing back to back to one another, facing in a different directions. And Americans basically, by themselves, they are mm-hmm. pushing us into this direction.
This is something that I wanted to ask you about, because you do believe that it's a major strategic mistake on the part of Washington to keep pushing for tighter consolidation between Beijing and Moscow. But there are a number of analysts in Russia who believe that it is also short-sighted on the part of Russia to pursue that consolidation. The relationship with Beijing, as you said, now is blossoming, but who knows what will happen in the future. I mean, I don't think Russia could ever imagine that the state of relationship with Ukraine would be as it is right now. Do you think Russia has a contingency plan, a contingency policy, in case the ties with Beijing go awry?
Russia is a historical pessimist, but it's also a great pragmatist. And it's a country which is responding to the situation very rapidly. In every my discussion with an American expert, I actually like check the boxes. They have this argument. You know, guys, we are your friend, actually. United States is your friend. While China, it would absorb you, it would attack you, etc., etc. And I said, you know, guys, in Russian, we have this proverb. С такими друзьями врагов не нужно. With friends like this, you don't need enemies.
So, but we also have a proverb, which is actually a quote from one of our czars, that Russia doesn't have friends at all. It only has its army and the navy.
The good strategy for any country is to have a strategic autonomy, to have an ability to choose partners, to choose allies. Russia does not want to build a deep alliance with China now. It wants to maintain the strategic autonomy it currently having. But the United States can force Russia to do this.
Now, we mentioned Mr. Bolton already, and he left a very thick trail of op-ed pieces, including one in the New York Times in 2010, in which he attacked the New START treaty. Do you think that agreement is also slated for demise now?
There is a good possibility of this happening, but I wouldn't say that it's bigger than 50%. We will see. There is no direct necessity for Americans to leave it right now. And actually, all this process is basically, it doesn't make the war closer, it just makes the world more uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bolton, in that specific article, in detailing the treaty's faults, He specifically mentioned, and I'm quoting here, the enormous disparities between Russian and American global responsibilities and the importance of America's nuclear umbrella in maintaining international security. It's another way of saying that Russia and the United States could not be treated as nuclear equals. Do you think that was 8 years ago? Do you think that would be Trump's position now?
Trump's position is in maintaining American primacy in military sphere wherever it's possible. And he is ready to sacrifice valued mutual decisions of previous decades. I think that's in experimenting in a strategically important sphere in a situation where peace can be very much fragile. And this is, I wouldn't say it's irresponsible, but in a way, strategically short-sighted.
But do you really think he can achieve any success with Putin if he comes to the table saying, you know, look, guys, Russia and the United States are on a different level when it comes to nuclear weapons. We understand that you guys have some, you know, stockpiles of it, but we, by definition, are much more important.
Zero chances.
Absolutely. So that perhaps would have to be either amended or expressed in a somewhat more polite language, I assume.
No, I think that like the predisposition to tackle this question this way, it would lead nowhere, basically. Yeah. Russia and United States are still holding the keys of the peace in the world.
And from what I understand, the position in Russia, or at least the perception within the Kremlin, is that Russia actually has an edge when it comes to nuclear weapons over the United States at the moment.
Well, you know this famous historical quotation from one Israeli prime minister when she was asked whether Israel has a nuclear weapon, and she responded in a way, "No, we don't. But if needed, we will use it."
Mr. Bolton is perceived in Russia as one of the biggest, harshest Russia hawks, and yet, both from his visit to Moscow and his publicized views, I got an impression that he was a much more comfortable interlocutor for the Kremlin than, let's say, Obama people who didn't see nuclear deterrence as a saving grace and who wished for a nuclear-free world. Is that an accurate perception that Russia, as counterintuitively as it is, finds it easier dealing with people like Mr. Bolton?
Well, stylistically, yes. In terms of the priority of the issue on the table, no. Obama administration and people around him tackling those issues, they were much more focused on the idea that proliferation of weapons of mass destruction is a grave threat, so we need Russia for this, but not for everything else that Russia is worried or concerned. So this asymmetry of perception actually made the reset so short-lived. With Bolton, they have on the agenda this IMF now, but witnessing the negative Russian reaction, I don't think that they will be glad that, you know, they wouldn't find a partner in Russia in this respect.
And very finally, if I may, you mentioned earlier that Russia is investing too much in its weaponry rather than in growing the expertise and perhaps honing its communication skills, because you wrote recently that possibly the most difficult challenge facing Russia today is the lack of finely honed communication skills. What's wrong with how Russia today speaks to the world?
I wasn't meaning specifically Russia Today.
You mean as a channel?
As a channel, yes.
But we are part of the outreach effort for sure.
Absolutely. I think that Russia has very strong arguments to the world. And we need to develop more comprehensively the framework, international communication framework, focused on stability, focused on the responsibility, focused on avoiding unnecessary confrontation.
But isn't it already there?
I think we underperforming in many respects, witnessing discussions on many international forums, being in foreign capitals. The problem is that, say, when I'm in New Delhi or in Beijing or in Tehran, people, experts I'm speaking with, they are taking the expertise on Russia from foreign sources. They are reading Chatham House, they are reading like CSIS and some other American, British, French outlets. Why not Russians? We are underperforming in this respect, and we have a very solid argumentation to provide with.
Well, I hope we filled at least part of that void that you mentioned. Thank you very much for coming over and sharing your insights.
Thank you.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.